Words from Windsor Castle. The life of Her Majesty the Queen as told through the broadcasts from Windsor Castle.
This is the BBC Home Service.
We know that in the end, all will be well.
Princess Elizabeth celebrates her 16th birthday by inspecting, as their new colonel, the Grenadier Guards at a special parade at Windsor Castle.
And as Princess Margaret famously said, we were supposed to go for the weekend and stayed 5 years.
Windsor Castle is one of the grandest buildings in England and the largest occupied castle in the world. And whether or not the flag is flying, the microphones and cameras have never been far away. For Her Majesty the Queen, the castle is cherished. It's where she grew up, spending many of the wartime years in its safety. And, as a princess, it's where she chose to make her first ever radio broadcast. October 1940.
Hello, children everywhere.
The BBC was then in the midst of a monthly series on Children's Hour. These regular features on this hugely popular programme were dedicated to children in wartime. From the BBC's Written Archive Centre at Caversham, Jeff Walden.
Well, this was very much an initiative of Derek McCulloch, the Children's Hour director, better known on the airwaves as Uncle Mac, and he particularly wanted to have a broadcast by Princess Elizabeth that would sort of unite the children who had been evacuated, not just within this country but overseas. And clearly the staff at the Royal Family thought this was a good idea.
At this time, the early TV broadcasts had ceased for the war and radio ruled. By 1940, a record 9.1 million wireless licenses had been issued. So for the young royal, aged just 14, there was a risk in a broadcast, as the press reported at the time.
The princess has never broadcast before, but that did not deter Uncle Mac. He besieged the big noises at the BBC and, when they wondered whether permission would be given, turned his attention to the Ministry of Information and pointed out how appropriate the broadcast would be. The King was doubtful at first whether Princess Elizabeth should broadcast, in view of her youth, a BBC official told the Daily Mirror, but he finally agreed.
Like so many British children, the princess was no stranger to the Children's Hour programme. In fact, in the march before the broadcast, Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret accompanied the King and Queen on a visit to Broadcasting House to witness a Children's Hour performance. So, letters went to and fro as the arrangements for this special live broadcast were finalised.
Unusually for a royal broadcast, the BBC did have some input into the content of the programme, so we do have sort of drafts on file here of the sort of things that were suggested that the princess might want to say. Sitting here at home in England before a microphone, the magic of wireless makes it possible for my voice to be heard all over the world. Our world means the British Empire, which is so dear to us, and I think in the final version that was made a bit more natural and less pompous, for want of a better word, I suppose.
Gene Seaton is Professor of Media History at the University of Westminster and the official historian of the BBC.
You could do it as, we are regal, or we are just children. And there is a kind of a row about that. Will you be squandering some of the royalty's value if you just say they're children? In the end, everybody plumps for a kind of sentimental version, a warm sentimental, and it's a children to other children.
This is one of the most important days in the history of Children's Hour. Some time ago, we were honoured by the visit to the studio of the King and Queen with Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret during the broadcast of a Toy Town programme. Today, Princess Elizabeth is herself to take part in the Children's Hour and speak to the children of the Empire at home and overseas.
So on the 13th of October 1940, with Princess Margaret by her side, the princess's voice was heard by her people for the very first time.
In wishing you all good evening, I feel that I am speaking to friends and companions who have shared with my sister and myself many a happy children's hour. Thousands of you in this country have had to leave your homes and be separated from your fathers and mothers.
I mean, if you listen to it now, it sounds a bit stilted, and they sound like upper-class little girls, which is what they are. Actually, it's natural to them. You know, it's authentic to what they are. They're not trying to be anything else. But it was a most amazingly important hit, and that was done from Windsor. And I think probably that sense of them being sort of in exile from their parents at Buckingham Palace. They weren't refugees, they hadn't been sent abroad, but they were in a sort of, they were in a different place.
Reaction to the broadcast was hugely enthusiastic at home and abroad. In Canada, it was reported that wirelesses had even been installed in churches, so the words from Windsor could be heard by all. Back home, the Star newspaper reported,
children cheered the princess on radio. Princess Elizabeth's voice was clearly heard in New Zealand, reports Reuters. Her message evoked a strong, responsive note, especially amongst young British children recently arrived in Wellington, who were thrilled at hearing the voice of their princess at the other side of the world. Hundreds of English children in the United States also cheered as her little speech ended. It was one of the most effective broadcasts ever received from London.
Within the British Empire, there's a lot of commentary about how this makes real the imperial link.
Simon Potter, Professor of Modern History at Bristol University.
By the early 1930s, the constitutional changes which had happened between Britain and its colonies had really meant that the only constitutional link between Britain and places like Canada, South Africa, Australia, was the monarchy. So this was, if you like, the pinnacle of the connection, imperial connection. And being able to put this on air and create that personal connection with listeners overseas was seen as being a very powerful expression of that continuing bond, the continuing Britishness of those sorts of communities.
And the desired audience for the Children's Hour broadcast went beyond the empire too.
People were right to be worried about American public opinion. American public opinion had not been pro-British. It regarded Britain as a nasty imperial power, unlike America, and in some odd way their enemy before the war. So worrying about American morale and public opinion was really good. So what do you deploy? You deploy your best ever asset, your highest quality, unheard of, junior, untarnished by experience or life or imperialism or... It's very difficult to describe what a valuable asset this first broadcast is. And it's children, you know, coming to the what's down our side. We've got lovely little girls, you know. I mean, it's a fantastic, fabulous asset.
But it was perhaps the very end of the Princess's Children's Hour broadcast from Windsor which caused the most affectionate comment, not least because it didn't seem to go quite to plan.
It was proposed that she should conclude with, then the day will have come when we shall be able to live happily in our own homes again. And now, as my sister Margaret is with me, we are both going to say goodbye to you. And Margaret says, goodbye, children. And Elizabeth then is supposed to say goodbye and good luck. I don't think that actually happened. But I think she had to cajole Margaret into saying those words. She would have been only about 10, so it would have been quite daunting for a little girl, I guess, stuck in front of a microphone with the whole empire in front of her.
You know, it was that wonderful bit at the end, which is all carefully discussed. You know, Margaret Rose, now you do your bit, kick. Margaret Rose does her bit.
My sister is by my side, and we are both going to say good night to you. Come on, Margaret. Good night, children. Good night, and good luck to you all.
The Star newspaper then reported,
since Princess Elizabeth's broadcast, I am told that many children in various parts of the country have seized upon Come on, Margaret as a catchphrase. They were all delighted by the elder princess's impromptu summons to her sister to say goodbye at the end of the broadcast. And now those three words are to be heard wherever a group of children is at play.
And if I may be allowed, I would like to say what is in the minds of all the children listening. Thank you, Princess Elizabeth, very much for broadcasting in the Children's Hour.
The princesses, I think, are kept in a kind of an aspic because they represent something of before the war. The princesses are frozen in that because it's kind of quite useful. And they represent two things. They represent the future, young, unblemished hopefulness, and the past, preserved family life and childishness.
During the dark days of war, aside from Children's Hour, radio played its role generally.
They've reduced the amount of radio stations which are broadcasting during the war to stop German bombers using radio stations to locate British cities using the radio signals. So really everybody's listening to the same programmes if you're listening to British radio in that period. in the early years of the war, I think a lot of the cinemas are shut down, and there's this real fear of congregating in public spaces, creating easy targets for disastrous incidents during bombing raids. So the home is a crucial place where people are seeking entertainment. In the early days of the war, I'm not quite sure the BBC gets it exactly right, but later on as well, there's this real sense that one of the purposes of radio should be to boost morale and to keep people's spirits up during the war. So there's already a movement to have more entertainment broadcast on the BBC, perhaps lighter programmes, less heavy classical music and political talks or non-political talks, cultural talks, more of an emphasis on entertainment. That's partly driven by the fact that the BBC is actually facing significant competition from stations like Radio Luxembourg by the late 1930s, who are broadcasting lots of light music, lots of records, lots of entertainment. The BBC wants to make sure its listeners don't desert it, so it's already moved towards more entertainment.
It's that man again.
The young princess and her parents were very keen on the BBC radio programme Itmar, It's That Man Again, starring Tommy Handley. So, in 1942, at the height of war, some correspondence was dispatched from Windsor Castle. Jeff Walden rifled through it at the Caversham Archives.
Well, it starts with a letter from Sir Piers Lee, Master of the Household at Windsor Castle, to Tommy Handley, care of BBC Bangor. Dear Sir, the King and Queen have expressed the desire to see a performance of your company. As you are in Wales, and not knowing what your professional engagements may be, I do not know whether it would be possible to arrange a performance at Windsor next month. An appropriate date would be about the 21st of April, which is Princess Elizabeth's birthday. If this could be arranged without serious inconvenience to yourself and your company, I would suggest that if you have an agent in London, he might come down to Windsor Castle and see the hall which is used for such entertainments. I wish to stress that their Majesties particularly desire that there should be no interference with any of your professional engagements.
And so it was that a private performance of the Itmar comedy show was staged at Windsor, complete with royal in-jokes. It was never broadcast, but it did feature Tommy Handley as usual, with guest appearances by Vera Lynn, Rob Wilton.
The day war broke out, my missus looked at me and she said, what good are you?
And Max Goldray on the harmonica from The Goon Show. That's the way to spend a very special birthday.
Princess Elizabeth celebrates her 16th birthday by inspecting, as their new colonel, the Grenadier Guards at a special parade at Windsor Castle. The occasion also marks her entry into the official life of the nation. Her Royal Highness the Colonel walks to the long ranks of guardsmen, followed by the King and Queen and Princess Margaret. Wearing the gold grenade badge of the Grenadiers in her hat, Princess Elizabeth makes her first military inspection.
Windsor's connection with radio stretches back far further than the 1940s, right back, in fact, to the birth of the medium itself.
This is Tuello, the London station of the British Broadcasting Company calling. Tuello calling.
In 1924, the Radio Times listing for the new London radio station 2LO highlighted this programme just after the General News Bulletin and before the Savoy Orpheans Band.
6th of March at 9:45 p.m. Mr. Alan S. Walker gives a talk on Windsor Castle.
And in November 1937...
The BBC National Programme, 7:25 p.m. Three Victorian plays by Lawrence Houseman. The scene? One of the private apartments at Windsor Castle in 1841.
This was a time, too, when the BBC itself was building its own reputation. Jean Seaton tells of how the young princess received a note from the Provost of Eton, who was helping to teach the Queen.
One of the papers that he sent her was about the future of the monarchy, and it says that, you know, broadcasting is going to determine the next century.
So had there been any reluctance from the royal family to participate in this young medium?
It's easy to say that, but when you look at, you know, King George V, who's got a reputation as being rather a stick-in-the-mud traditionalist, but he embraced the new medium and almost made it his own, really. He could have said, I'm not interested in any of this newfangled stuff. But, you know, he inaugurated the Christmas Day broadcasts, which are a tradition, obviously, to this day. And he was very good at it.
And fittingly, it was the burial of King George V in 1936, which was to be one of the first major events covered by media at Windsor.
Following bulletin was issued at 9:25. The King's life is moving peacefully towards its close. Signed, Frederick Willans, Stanley Hewitt, Dawson of Penn. All stations of the British Broadcasting Corporation will now close down until 10 p.m. when a further announcement will be made.
From Sandringham, the King's body travelled to King's Cross Station, from where he was taken to Westminster Hall for the lying in state, and finally to St George's Chapel, Windsor, for the funeral service and burial.
As the funeral train draws into Windsor Station, 100,000 people are waiting in the little town from which our royal family takes its name. Because of the enormous crowds in London, the train is over half an hour late. Again, the sad procession is formed, smaller than that which moved through the London streets, but still magnificently impressive, as the King of England walks behind his dead father and the sorrowing Queen rides in the slow-moving carriage.
And, of course, again, the BBC was responsible for broadcasting this to the world. We have an announcement here on file, giving some of the, what were then, extremely difficult technical arrangements. You know, 16 microphones, including those in St George's Chapel, were installed. 2 microphones for the special use of foreign officials. 27 telephone circuits, especially installed, for relaying this thing over the telephone network. And there's a list of the countries to which the funeral service was relayed.
But it was later that year that Windsor was the scene for one of radio's most dramatic broadcasts ever, following this announcement.
This is London. A quarter of an hour ago, the Prime Minister came to the bar of the House and handed to the Speaker a message from His Majesty the King. Here is the text of the message, which was read by the Speaker. After long and anxious consideration, I have determined to renounce the throne to which I succeeded on the death of my father.
The famous voice of BBC newsreader Alvar Liddell. The reason, of course, for all the royal shenanigans was love.
Today, the American press is filled with rumours of royal romance, of the possibility of King Edward marrying Mrs. Wallace Simpson, the former Baltimore Belle. Yesterday, as a girl, she lived in Maryland, in this quiet and humble Baltimore home. Tomorrow, she may dwell in Buckingham Palace. And in this topsy-turvy world, it may be time for an American woman to marry a British king.
Reaction was less cheery back in the then British Empire. A true constitutional crisis, in fact. Wallis Simpson was an American socialite who was divorced from her first husband and was in the process of divorcing her second.
The Daily Herald, December 11th, 1936. The King abdicates. Will broadcast tonight. Leaving country. May go to Rome.
And in the Times,
King Edward to broadcast a message tonight. It was announced at the end of the 9 o'clock news bulletin last night that the BBC had been informed that it was King Edward's desire immediately he has ceased to be king to broadcast. The broadcast will be made by him this evening in the character of a private person owing allegiance to the new king. After the king has spoken, all BBC transmitters will close down.
The man who gave the orders for that media close down was BBC Director General John Reith, who introduced the broadcast himself. Listen closely.
This is Windsor Castle, His Royal Highness Prince Edward.
Well, we've got Reith's diary here, his personal diary.
I then left the chair on the left side, having got him to stand right of it. In getting down, he gave the table an awful kick, which came over quite clearly.
Some listeners suggested the banging of the table leg had actually been the DG slamming the door, being none too pleased at what was happening. The words were carefully chosen too.
And he records on the day in question, the 11th of December, as late as that morning, they still didn't know what to what title to use to introduce the former king. He says here that this was about 1:52 p.m. Cloverley of Number 10 said we should call him His Royal Highness Prince Edward, and that the new title would not be conferred today. The new title, I suppose, would have been Duke of Windsor, as of course. So clearly, you can see the sort of panic and last minuteness of the whole business.
The momentous broadcast that followed of just 537 painful words could have been very different. It later emerged the king had sought to make a last-minute plea by radio to win public support for his proposed marriage and avoid the abdication. But it wasn't to be.
At long last, I am able to say a few words of my own. I have never wanted to withhold anything. But until now, it has not been constitutionally possible for me to speak. A few hours ago, I discharged my last duty as King and Emperor. And now that I have been succeeded by my brother, the Duke of York, my first words must be to declare my allegiance to him. This I do with all my heart.
Reith is very concerned about what's happening with Edward. He's got a visceral hatred for Wallace Simpson as well. He's in close contact with the Prime Minister as well, and he's there in person when Edward makes the broadcast announcing his abdication.
Yes, it would have been in the private quarters, of course, used by the former king. But he writes here, left at 9:05 in the evening, this is, and got to Windsor at 9:30. I was expected, and the car took me to the door of the private quarters. Here were a red-coated footman, the majordomo, and the housekeeper. Went up to the room where the broadcast was to take place.
It was a little corridor of three rooms, bedroom at end. This was the suite the king always used. The microphones were in the centre room. I had just looked around when I got an agitated message to go down to the door to receive the king, who was well on his way from Royal Lodge, where the family, including Queen Mary, was dining. It struck me as rather odd that I should receive him in his own house.
Monckton told me the king had actually wanted to say goodbye to his family before the broadcast, but he had persuaded him to go back after. The king went to pump ship. That's a Reithian term for to urinate. The king went to pump ship in a place between the bedroom and the sitting room, saying he didn't know when he would use that place again, and leaving the door open.
He had on a light suit, fur coat, and was smoking a big cigar. Seemed very glad to see me. I should have said that Godfrey T had found that the king wanted me to be there myself. Next thing I considered a lot was whether I should announce him myself. Decided to do so. He didn't seem any different from usual. Good evening, Reith. Very nice of you to make all these arrangements and come along yourself. Going upstairs, I told him there was no chance of failure, as everything was duplicated.
It's exactly the sort of national event that the BBC would see itself in that period as having a duty to cover in the correct way, cover in a way that supports the monarchy, perhaps rather than Edward, supports the monarchy as an institution rather than Edward's, and supports the British government. And Reith is there on hand in person during the speech that Edward gives on air. So it's a preoccupation for Reith, it's a preoccupation for senior people at the BBC, and it's something they see as very important.
But you must believe me when I tell you that I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do, without the help and support of the woman I love.
Reading Reith's own account, you see both his own personal views of what's happening and his own often quite visceral reactions combined with a sense of public duty and what the BBC should be doing in its duty to the British nation and its listeners. And they're sort of balanced there in his diary accounts.
I said it was awful that all this crisis was caused by a miserable second-rate American woman.
The words of John Reith reflecting on the most famous broadcast ever made from Windsor Castle. Mrs. Simpson listened in on her radio on the French Riviera.
Reith thinks he does a very good job. Reith thinks the BBC... Reith often thought he did a very good job, but he thought the BBC did very, very well in handling the broadcast. And again, it's something which goes out to the world. It's a broadcast which is listened to in Australia, New Zealand, Canada. These are places where the monarchy is seen as being very, very important still and a crucial connection among people who feel loyal to the empire, loyal to the monarchy. So it goes beyond an idea of national unity and it goes out to something that's much more global as well.
This is London. It is with the greatest sorrow that we make the following announcement. It was announced from Sandringham at 10:45 today, February the 6th, 1952, that the King, who retired to rest last night in his usual health, passed peacefully away in his sleep earlier this morning.
The princess was overseas when her father died, but she returned home to Windsor, as did he.
And so to the resting place of kings, the beautiful chapel of St. George, built of Cotswold stone and Surrey oak 400 years ago.
The BBC offers profound sympathy to Her Majesty the Queen and the royal family. The BBC is now closing down for the rest of the day, except for the advertised news bulletins and summaries, shipping forecasts and gale warnings.
The Archbishops of Canterbury and York wait to receive the King, and the Navy pipes the Admiral over the side.
Princess Elizabeth became the Queen, and her long reign began. But Windsor Castle was still to play a huge role in her life. What was the attraction of this building on its hilltop site, the oldest inhabited castle in the world?
She definitely did say somewhere it was her happiest childhood memories. And I think in lots of ways she wasn't being bombed. There's something about her stoic everydayness, which I think one still recognises. The Queen takes the day as it comes. She's immensely professional at taking what comes at her. We know that occasionally, in the subtlest of ways, she sends shots over bows. So, you know, driving the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia's father round was a shot over the bows. You know, not asking Mrs. Thatcher to sit down after Granada had been invaded is a shot over the bows. So she's a very adept shot. I mean, I think there's an openness to experience, but a closeness to showing what you're feeling about it.
As the then princess came of age in 1944, the Sunday Express suggested
her favourite recreation is to ride in the park at Windsor with her father.
Here's one of the Queen's former footmen, Stephen Scott Kay.
She can ride in private. It's very unlikely that a long lens from the long mile end of the driveway is ever going to capture her riding. Whereas at Buckingham Palace, as you probably know, the gardens are overlooked by officers, so you could always snap the Queen. But she feels very, very safe at Windsor.
When the Queen married in 1947, a private ceremony at Windsor was considered. But the Duke of Leeds wrote to her, suggesting that in a choice between sensible post-war austerity and the traditional pageantry, he thought most people would prefer pageantry. And that same year, the future Queen became the first woman to be given the title Freeman of the Borough. She described Windsor as very dear to me. She said, I regard it as a home in a way no other place can be. And I come here today as a citizen of Windsor.
I do solemnly and sincerely declare
that I will be subject and obedient to all the good order and customs of this borough. I shall not consent to or do anything whereby this town or the freedom thereof may be damnified. If I happen to know of any conspiracy or mischief against this borough, I shall with all convenient speed disclose the same to the mayor or other magistrates of this borough.
Early in 1948, the couple's first marital home was just down the road at Windlesham Moor, originally part of Windsor Forest. What's it like inside the castle? Former footman Stephen Scott Lay.
It's very grand. Everyone likes going to Windsor. A, you get to see the Queen more intimately. You know, you're in a red crown car, you can just sweep through the gates, and that's all very nice. When you're in convoy with the Queen, that's quite good. It's just a beautiful setting. Inside, it's very lovely, it's very grand, but of course only the grand rooms are used for only state occasions. The Queen occupies a very small part of the castle. Great view of the back, beautiful garden. She likes to walk the dogs there, and she still rides at Windsor at nearly 92. I personally think that it's probably her favourite home. The Prime Minister used to come to Buckingham Palace at 6 o'clock on a Tuesday for the private audience, and that now happens at Buckingham Palace at 6 o'clock on a Wednesday. The reason for that is the Queen likes to go to Windsor after lunch on a Friday, and she used to return at on Tuesday after lunch, but now she returns on a Wednesday. So she's really only at Buckingham Palace probably 2 days a week. The rest of the time she'll be at Windsor. When she's in London, she's mostly at Windsor. Of course, we're up in Balmoral for 8 weeks, Sandringham for 4 at Christmas.
Darren McGrady was a royal chef. He now lives in America.
The Queen calls Buckingham Palace the office, and she's there Monday to Friday. And she can't wait to get out the door and off to Windsor Castle. And as soon as she gets there, she sort of changes and takes the dogs and goes off down that long walk. I used to live in the grounds of Windsor Castle, Frogmore Stables. So I'd see her out walking the dogs, and the Queen absolutely adores being at Windsor.
The kitchens really are very, very special from a staff point of view. They had a huge refit a couple of years before I joined, actually. It must be in the 90s that they had the refit. But it really is fantastic, which is why they prefer a state banquet there, because the kitchens really can cater for huge numbers. And it's absolutely beautiful, you know, old copper pans hanging from the ceiling, everything a chef could possibly want.
My first trip there, staying in a room where the walls are 10 inches thick and I can't put a picture on the wall because I can't get a nail in because the walls are so thick.
We've got lovely bedrooms, actually, at Windsor. Yeah, we get assigned a room by the chief housekeeper, and you get your little name on the door, and you have to go up and find... And I always thought the rooms were very warm. The central heating at Windsor must be amazing, because we always thought the rooms were really warm, and you'd have to go and turn your radiator off. Whereas you'd think it'd be the other way around, but actually it's a warm place.
And what of Her Majesty's media consumption? How much of what is said and written about her is seen? Stephen Scott Lay.
She does listen to some of the radio, actually, yeah. She listens to some of the BBC channels. She also reads most of the newspapers. One of the footmen put on her breakfast table the newspapers in the following order, with the headers showing Times, Telegraph, Independent, Express, Mail, Mirror, with a racing post on the top. Should expect.
Windsor serves too as a final resting ground for many royals.
The coffin, draped with the Duke's personal standard, was carried by men of the 1st Battalion Welsh Guards. When Prince of Wales, he'd have become the first colonel of the regiment. This afternoon, the Duchess, with only the Queen and a few other members of the family and close friends, went to the royal burial ground at Frogmore, where the Duke was buried.
The burial of the Duke of Windsor in 1972. Monarchs and their spouses are almost all buried in St George's Chapel. Others are tucked away at the royal family's hidden burial ground at Frogmore in Windsor Castle's home park. That's where Her Majesty walks her corgis, and where George VI and the Queen Mother spent their honeymoon. 2002 brought the funeral of the Queen Mother, and the Queen made a televised address from Windsor Castle the night before.
Ever since my beloved mother died over a week ago, I have been deeply moved by the outpouring of affection which has accompanied her death. My family and I always knew what she meant for the people of this country, and the special place she occupied in the hearts of so many here, in the Commonwealth, and in other parts of the world. But the extent of the tribute that huge numbers of you have paid my mother in the last few days has been overwhelming.
Here within the walls of Windsor Castle in St. George's Chapel at 6 o'clock this evening, a very simple, a very private committal service attended by just 10 members of the royal family in the little King George VI Memorial side chapel in St. George's Chapel. Under the black marble slab, the Queen Mother's coffin was laid to rest in the vault there beside the coffin of her late husband, her beloved Bertie, King George VI. And into that vault also was placed the ashes of Princess Margaret, her particular specific wish that she also should lie beside her father, in particular George VI. And for that purpose, because the vault is so small, she elected for cremation, and her ashes were placed there this evening.
The Queen's Christmas message has now become part of the annual tradition. In 1982, on television, it came from the library of Windsor Castle for the first time.
It is 50 years since the BBC external service was started, and my grandfather, King George V, made the first Christmas broadcast from Sandringham.
Wreath wanted to use the BBC to promote national unity.
Simon Potter, Professor of Modern History at Bristol University.
And when you think about the very early years of broadcasting in the 20s, there's all sorts of challenges after the First World War, concerns about the stability of society after this tumultuous conflict. And then the very first Royal Christmas broadcasts, yes, they're to the Empire, but also they're going to be heard in Britain. And this is the time of the national government. This is the time of the Great Depression and real concerns about national unity, people being excluded from the economy, from politics and society. So I'm not sure it's so much a personal link, it's much more the sense that bringing in the monarchy, bringing them on air, is a way to promote this mission of national unity, which is central to what the BBC thinks it's meant to be doing in the 1920s and 1930s.
Through one of the marvels of modern science, I am enabled this Christmas Day to speak to all my peoples throughout the Empire.
Outside broadcast can carry a heavy bill. Jeff Walden looked back through the accounts in the Caversham archives.
Well, this is just a routine document, really. It's an advice of an outside broadcast from Christmas 1942, when the King made one of his famous Christmas Day broadcasts as the end of the Empire Roundup. And yes, it shows that he was engaged to broadcast from 1500 hours to 1512, all adding up to £12.10. So I suppose that's reasonably good value for something that was listened to around the world by millions.
Today I'm speaking to you from the library at Windsor Castle, in a room which was once occupied by Queen Elizabeth I. This is my home, where for many years now, my family and I have celebrated Christmas. Within a few feet of where I am standing is the cliff with its wonderful commanding view over the Thames, which led William the Conqueror to build a castle on this ideal defensive position, a castle which has to this day been the home of kings and queens.
The 1992 Christmas message was poignant for the Queen personally. It had been a horrible year.
Like many other families, we have lived through some difficult days this year. The prayers, understanding and sympathy given to us by so many of you, in good times and bad, have lent us great support and encouragement.
Annus Horribilis, the mythic, well-ordered model royal family breaking up on all sides. You know, Charles and Diana at each other's throats. Fergie, the royal family had kept the lid on a mythic story of being a sort of model family, and this was exploding in all directions. They go on the bit vulgar and terrible, the royal knockout. I mean, genuinely awful. So in the middle of really bad mood music, Republicans, you know, people like Will Hutton saying, you know, Britain needs to grow up and get a written constitution and get rid of this trivial relationship, all of this stuff.
The Daily Mirror, Fergie's stolen kisses.
The Daily Mail, Diana in Love Tape Mystery.
The Daily Telegraph, Queen tells Charles to divorce.
The Daily Mirror, Andy and Fergie are set to part.
The Daily Mail, end of the fairy tale. The Sun, how much can a mum take? The Queen hides anguish at another royal breakup.
And then suddenly, there is a catastrophic fire at Windsor. This is absolutely huge, destroys great swathes of Windsor.
The Daily Mail, history in flames.
The Sun, 4 a.m, castle still burns.
The largest inhabited castle in the world, with some 1,000 rooms, was in the grip of a major blaze. And before long, 150 firemen were trying to control the flames. Their task was made all the more urgent by the need to protect, as best they could, the priceless works of art, furnishings and armour.
Sir Hugh Roberts, Surveyor Emeritus of the Queen's Works of Art.
We all saw from the car a red glow in the sky, just a wall of flame all the way along the north side of the castle. Absolute horror, because Windsor Castle contains about half of the most important things in the royal collection. 600 Leonardos, for example. Wonderful paintings, fantastic furniture, tapestries, the lot.
Royal chef Darren McGrady was on the scene.
I got a knock at the door and was asked to come up and help. And I went up there and I was actually in the quadrangle and I was changing oxygen packs for the firemen. And the Queen's page saw me and said, Darren, would you come and help? You have security clearance, would you come and help inside? And I remember going into the castle. Paul Wybrew, who's now the Queen's page, he said, we need to empty the Queen's bedroom and private apartment. And so I was in there picking up sort of all the Queen's personal items and helping to carry them out onto the veranda. And I actually turned around and the Queen had just arrived and there she was, stood there, you know, again, just picking up. She bent over and picked up some shoes and I didn't say anything, but it was humbling, you know, seeing that.
Prince Andrew and guards actually are behaving quite well. They're against the fire and officer's instruction are taking down pictures, which is obviously the right thing to do, if you see what I mean. So there's this picture at the height of royal vulnerability of royal palace on fire. And then it turns out that the public are going to pay for it. And at the same time, I think that if you see pictures of the Queen, I mean, you know, this had been her childhood home. This was a catastrophe. She was there. But, you know, if you've had a fire or a flood, when I was a teenager, there was a fire in my parents' home. And they are very destructive psychological things, actually. They're quite difficult to take on, that kind of destruction of stuff. And it had been dangerous and, you know, all of that. So that fire felt like the apogee of a sort of disastrous royal family.
The restoration took 5 years and with it, a restoration of the royal family reputation. The amount of time the Queen spends at Windsor Castle means the area gets more than its fair share of VIPs. There are state visits from overseas monarchs and presidents, foreign heads of state in horse-drawn carriages, and traditional state banquets held in St George's Hall. The table there seats up to 160 guests.
It's very, very grand. Whereas the ballroom at Buckingham Palace, where the state banquet is very grand in itself, but with Windsor Castle, it's something very special because you've got like a mezzanine where the trumpeters play, whereas you don't have the same acoustics, if you like, at Buckingham Palace. And then in the St George's Hall at Windsor, you've got all the ancient royal arms all the way around. It just looks incredibly imposing, if you like, for a dignitary that's visiting. And actually, I think we tend to prefer it because you can really show off at Windsor, whereas you can at the palace, but not in the same way.
Royal footman Stephen Scott Lay. Last year, Barack Obama arrived by helicopter for a private lunch the day after the Queen's 90th birthday. He touched down on the golf course. The Duke got behind the wheel of the Queen's Range Rover and Barack took his place in the passenger seat. His wife joined the Queen in the back. In 2012, the sovereigns of 26 countries arrived for a luncheon at the castle to mark the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. Some of those heads of state weren't universally popular in this country. Longer ago, 1986 saw the state visit of the King and Queen of Spain. 1956 saw the Soviet Union leader Khrushchev received at Windsor Castle.
Ronald and Nancy Reagan stayed at the castle in 1982. The President and the Queen rode horses side by side in Windsor Great Park. When the Queen extends a key invitation, it's most often to Windsor Castle. 1999, at another wedding at St George's Chapel.
Edward, wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded wife, to live together according to God's law in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou love her, comfort her, honour and keep her in sickness and in health, and forsaking all other, keep thee only unto her, so long as ye both shall live?
I will.
Sophie, wilt thou have this man?
After the ceremony, a procession of open-topped horse-drawn carriages carried Edward and Sophie from the chapel to the reception at St George's Hall in Windsor. It was the last royal wedding of the century at the castle, and the millennium's final Christmas message was filmed there too, in the white drawing room.
A time to reflect on the events of the past year and to make resolutions for the new year ahead. This December, we are looking back not just 1 year, but on 100 years and 1,000 years. History is measured in centuries. More than ever, we are aware of being a tiny part of the infinite sweep of time.
Each time the cameras and microphones are trained on Windsor for a special occasion, the streets are lined for the borough and its many visitors. This is your castle.
Prince Edward and the Countess of Wessex have just got out. Countess of Wessex wearing a grey outfit. We can see the Princess Royal, who's wearing a very bright turquoise outfit, all making their way now pretty briskly up the steps of the Windsor Guildhall, going through those two central doors in the middle and making their way then upstairs inside to the Ascot Room where this civil ceremony is going to take place.
Well, I'm very proud. This is all happening in Windsor.
Uh-huh.
I just live up the road in Fifield, and it seems to me as though virtually everybody from all over the world's here.
Yeah, sure.
So I think everybody locally should get themselves out and get here.
It's such a lovely day as well.
Exactly.
It is this kind of thing that makes Windsor special, isn't it, fundamentally?
It makes us special, I think, and we should all be proud to be British. It's just absolutely marvellous. And as I say, most of the world would like to be putting on something like this today, and we're here and they're all watching us, and I think it's absolutely marvellous.
Excitement on the radio at Windsor on the day the future king married. The art of commentary on big royal occasions is now recognised. It has a style and a pace, whether coronation, wedding or funeral. Robin Lustig was at Radio 4.
Live commentary is different from live presenting or reporting because you're not a reporter, you're not a news person, you're a commentator. You're simply describing what you see. And obviously at a funeral, the tone is different and the whole pace of the broadcast is different.
To what extent has the pageantry of our monarchy influenced the development of that broadcasting style? BBC historian Jean Seaton.
Both broadcasting and the monarchy bring off ceremonies in our collective interest. Now, some of those have been royal events. I remember watching with a new baby on my lap, Lady Di. My husband had gone off to work, so that was just the kind of thing he would do. Watching Lady Di getting married, and we had staying with us a radical Republican leader of the council in Middlesbrough. And Dave said he didn't want to watch the royal wedding because he was a Republican and he didn't believe in it and he thought it was a load of, you know, whatever you say in Middlesbrough. I said, well, I'm going to watch it. So I sat down with the baby on my knee and he came and watched, and by the end he was in tears. But it was because the ceremony spoke to him about his life, about marriage, which he didn't have. There was me with my baby, and about our collective lives. So I think that the BBC may have learnt something, hadn't thought of that before, from how the monarchy went about doing ceremony. At its best, and certainly in the ceremonies I've looked at, the BBC and the monarchy collaborate to hold on to the meaning.
So the media around the world prepare, and Windsor hosts another royal wedding in 2018. As the royal family arrive to send off another of their own, what will Her Majesty be thinking as the couple smile and take their vows in the castle which breathes so much tradition over so many years?
Oh, poor old Queen. She's seen so many. Well, I mean, who knows what she will be thinking? That is the miracle. We haven't the foggiest what the Queen thinks. She's a person with an interior life to whom we have absolutely no access. So I don't know what the Queen will be thinking. But one gets the sense that she's quite happy with those grandchildren. She's probably a bit happier with them than she was with her own children. You know, it's another one getting married, another one off the aisle. You know, in the bigger story of the family and the royal family, it looks like a quite interesting marriage. It's a bit more like a family event. I mean, these days, weddings have got so big out there in the population, it probably isn't that much bigger than the weddings that's going on in, you know, down the road. One assumes she will be pleased. One assumes it will be quite more relaxing because it's at Windsor, that it has a certain, slightly more intimate relationship. What's extraordinary is to be of a generation to see your grandchildren married. And that connection over the generation strikes me as being also something that's about to go, because everybody's delaying having their children so long. So we won't be seeing our grandchildren married, because we didn't have our... She had her children, as people did, young. So the generations are still, in her case, rather concertinaed.
Words from Windsor Castle was a Radio Moments production for BBC Radio Berkshire. The programme was presented by David Lloyd, with the voices of Vicky Brakewell, Rennie Griffiths and Andy Marriott.
I loved hearing that. It's available on the iPlayer. If you stumbled across it halfway through, you're thinking, what's this? Words from Windsor Castle, part of today's Peach Show on the iPlayer. Tomorrow, we're on the long walk. Getting ready. We've got a big band coming. We've got a whole cast of Americans coming. We've got people who are already... bag the best vantage spots coming. Please join us if you can for our programme from the Long Walk in Windsor. Tomorrow from 7, then Saturday from 8. Sarah's here right now.
Lovely, thank you.
BBC Radio Berkshire. Travel you trust, as it happens.